On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
It's the 77th anniversary of D-Day, the long-anticipated invasion of Fortress Europe by the Allied military that sealed the doom of Nazi Germany. We have a very interesting guest today and a very interesting book to talk about. The guest is Dr. Whitney Bendick, who is professor and director of Undergraduate Studies International Affairs Program at Florida State University, the author of A Force, The Origins of British Deception During the Second World War, and her newest book, Diversion and Deception, Dudley Clark's A Force and Allied Operations in World War II. It's from the University of Oklahoma Press. You can check their website at oupress.com. And thank you so much for making time to talk to us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
You got interested in this fella, Dudley Clark, talks about the eight different missions that he was given to fulfill and which he did a beautiful job on during World War II in the European theater, correct?
Yes.
What in particular kind of got your attention? Was it the deception and diversion aspect of it, or is it just this is a pretty fascinating fellow, or a little both?
Really, it was a bit of both. All of this started out when I was an undergraduate and was doing a research topic on the double agents who were active prior to D-Day. And I was reading a book on fortitude by Roger Hethcus, who was one of the London planners. And he just made this very quick comment early in his book saying, "And we called Dudley Clark from the Mediterranean to London to tell us about his deception organization." And I thought, well, who in the world is that? And how does he have this expert knowledge? And that's really what started all of this. So when I started researching A-Force, I really didn't know all that much about it, but found it fascinating and Clark just to be this amazing individual that I was surprised so few people knew about.
He certainly did a good job in hiding his involvement, although toward the end of the book you did mention that he was hoping to tell the story of what A-Force did, but never got that opportunity. So you're filling that role for him, which I think is really lovely.
That's true, although I hate that he wasn't able to tell his own story,
because
I would have loved to have heard it from his own words.
Now, World War II witnessed the greatest use of deception in the history of warfare. There had been things before, the Trojan horse and so forth, but this was on a whole new scale, wasn't it?
It was. Absolutely.
Your book talks about, starts out in the Mediterranean. That was the first place that the United States kind of got involved in what Dudley Clark had put together with A-Force, correct?
Yes, they came in with Operation Torch in North Africa. So that's November of 1942. So that would be the beginning of the American involvement, both in terms of the military campaign, but also in participating in deception with A-Force.
Why was World War II a conflict that saw a growing need for deceiving the enemy? Was it because of the ferocity of the enemy or the success that Nazi Germany had exhibited so far, or maybe a combination of these things? What made World War II different as far as the idea of deception and diversion?
I think really you have multiple things at play there. One is you can't forget the legacy of World War I. It was, you know, carnage on such an unbelievable scale, and nobody wanted to see that again. And so obviously to win wars, they were going to have to find a way to break those frontal deadlocks that they saw during World War I, especially with trench warfare. So interwar planning did a lot to think about ways to maintain a war of maneuver. So you have that on the military side. But then deception could be used also to try to keep the enemy off balance, and in that way, you know, render them weak, render them vulnerable, so that battles would not deadlock like they did in the First World War. You also have Churchill, who learned a tremendous lesson with the Battle of Gallipoli.
Right.
And with that battle, of course, there was no cover or deception for an amphibious operation. And he took away that legacy and the lesson that you could not carry out an invasion of that sort without some sort of cover and deception. So in World War II, you have a prime minister who is very receptive to using deception. Then you have Britain's position going into World War II. They weren't prepared. They had a mentality that was very opposed to war in the interwar period, so they were not prepared to fight a major war which means when they found themselves at war against first Italy and then Italy and the Germans in North Africa, they just did not have the manpower. They didn't have the material to fight that war. And fortunately, they had some creative-minded leaders on the ground, such as Archibald Wavell, who was willing to resort to deception as a force maximizer. And then really the last thing I would say that plays into World War II as opposed to other wars was simply where we were in terms of development. Technology had gone to much greater lengths, and so that provided capabilities that simply didn't exist in wars past.
Had it been for the carnage of World War I, where you just have two armies slamming against each other time and time again, mm-hmm. nobody goes anywhere except all of the bodies mount up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I like about Dudley Clark is that his motivation for running these kind of programs, these campaigns, was to minimize not only the loss of life on their side, but also to cut back on the loss of life of the enemy. If you con the enemy into thinking you're going to attack at point B and instead you attack at point A, yeah. and they've got tons and tons of soldiers over at B waiting for you to come ashore, and they never do, those guys are going to be saved.
Right, and Clark had a lot of respect for the Germans. He had, you know, formed relations with some German officers during the interwar, and he had a lot of respect for them. He wasn't one of these bloodthirsty individuals who was looking to, you know, see casualties mount. He wanted to avoid them.
And certainly the kind of cons, if you will, that they ran were brilliant, and for the most part, they were very successful, and there were times that they did not have much opportunity to develop a big plan, did they? So they had to be very creative, and they had to be very resourceful, and they had to have a lot of cooperation from the military involved, and that was sometimes kind of tricky, right?
It was, especially where the Air Force was concerned. So Clark seemed to get a lot of support from the Army. He had very good support from the Navy, but it was the Air Force that was more problematic. And I don't think it was altogether an unwillingness to participate in deception so much as the fact that resources were scarce.
Yeah.
And when you're telling the Air Force that they need to divert all of these bombers or reconnaissance units to these areas that really don't have anything to do with the battle, they don't want to do that.
Yeah.
And so he had a lot of pushback, and even pilots who didn't understand why they were bombing targets that had nothing to do with the actual attack. There's a morale factor that plays into that.
Sure, sure. You want to just walk us through these missions that Dudley Clark and A Force did during the Mediterranean campaign, and also still in the Med, but trying to divert attention from the Normandy landings?
Sure. I guess I'll go over it kind of surface level, but when the North African campaign came to an end in May of 1943, really the big question was, what was going to happen next? And this is where you did see a dispute between the British and American leadership, because the Americans were more gung-ho, let's invade France. And the British, who were a lot more experienced at this time, felt that's an impossibility. The Germans are too strong in France. The Allies were too weak and unprepared for a successful amphibious operation. And so as discussions played out between the British chiefs of staff and the American joint chiefs of staff, they finally did come to an agreement on what's known as the Mediterranean strategy. And the idea there was to exploit the Mediterranean theater as a diversionary theater. So in other words, to keep the Germans from reinforcing northwestern France, they would create threats from southern France all the way to the Balkans to keep the Germans in southern Europe away from France. There would only be, you know, a handful of genuine operations which go from Sicily and up the peninsula of Italy. The rest of it is largely going to be maintained through diversionary threats, and that's where A Force came in.
The cover of the book, we can't hold it up to the microphone and show people, which is too bad, but you have pictures of a dummy Mosquito, the British airplane, and dummy landing craft that are being prepared for the invasion of Greece. Part of the Mediterranean plan that was so interesting to me is that apparently the Germans were very concerned that the Brits, who had a relationship with Greece in the past, that Greece would be a place that they would invade and work their way through the Balkans upwards toward Germany, right?
Right, kind of a back door
mm-hmm.
into Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So Hitler had a tremendous fear about Greece. And that played up to the deceptionist schemes, because when Hitler is the one who's concerned, that means you're more likely to have success with deceptions, playing up that threat. So they would hit the Balkans over and over with these diversionary threats. So, yes, the Balkans was always a vulnerability. There was also a very active partisan movement there that gave the Germans a lot of trouble. So that was another, just another layer to all of that.
How much do we have to invest in, say, providing war materials to, say, the partisans in Yugoslavia in order to keep this deception going that the Balkans were going to be the next big staging area?
You know, I never saw anything that gave any sort of actual figures, but it does factor into the A-Force reports pretty regularly that they were offering support through the SOE, the British SOE, the American OSS. So we were providing support to the partisans also in France. But in terms of what that actually looked like in terms of weapons, material, or money, that was never stated.
One of the interesting deceptions is set up early on in the book about the idea that we would be involved in Turkey, that the Allies would try to get Turkey to quit being a neutral nation and come in on the side of the Allies against Germany. Which would have been a good position because Bulgaria is just right across the Dardanelles and so forth. They set up an op that would make it look like we were very, very interested in helping Turkey get into the war. And this is a typical kind of operation as part of the larger overarching plans, right?
It was. To be fair, Churchill was the most enthusiastic about trying to get Turkey on board. And, of course, Turkey joined the Germans in World War One, so the Allies were pretty keen to keep Turkey from going in that direction. But, yes, this was, you know, another one of those areas that would be of particular concern for the Germans, also with their position in the Eastern Front. So it also played very well into deception. And that, as you mentioned, ended up being a running theme throughout 1943, 44, even into 45, of continuing to play up that threat of using Turkey and swaying the Turks to come over to the Allied side.
We're talking, in case you're joining us late, to Dr. Whitney Bendick, who's the author of Diversion and Deception, Dudley Clark's A-Force and Allied Operations in World War II. It's from the University of Oklahoma Press. Sicily looked to be the obvious jumping point after Operation Torch was concluded, because it's just basically right across the Med. And so that was one reason that they tried to do the diversion tactics and deception of involving Turkey or involving Greece and so forth. Italy ended up being a place that needed more than one plan in order to work from Sicily all the way up to Rome, right?
Yes. As you mentioned, Sicily was the most obvious, and that was the real challenge with the deception, how to make something that's so obvious not appear to be the obvious target. But yes, after Sicily, and that strategically was a bit of a mess because the Americans and British had not come to a consensus about what was going to happen after Sicily. So the invasion of the peninsula was a bit ad hoc. But with that, the Allies thought that the Germans would evacuate the southern part of Italy. And that's because we were privy to their intelligence reports as a result of the work at Bletchley Park. And that was what seemed to be the agreement at that time, that the Germans would withdraw north. That changed. The German General Kesselring was able to convince Hitler that he could stand and fight in southern Italy. Not win, but that he could draw this out into a long, very costly war for the Allies. And so what we thought was going to be a quick drive north to Rome wasn't. It ended up being years of warfare. And because of that, yes, we see multiple different deception plans go into play for Italy. And where they're a little bit different from what we see in the west of the Mediterranean is largely what A-Force did in the Mediterranean as a diversion was create strategic deceptions, whereas what we see in Italy oftentimes was focused more on tactical deception.
Difference between tactical and strategic deception. Strategic meaning an overarching concept, and tactical is how do we get this done?
Yeah, more or less. So strategic, you're putting together a big plan, trying to convince the Germans of the overarching theme of what's going on. You're really focused on the German high command, their intelligence service, and specifically Hitler as well, in conveying the message of those strategic goals. Tactical is going to be on the ground. You're influencing more the commanders on the ground. Both can use physical, but obviously you see a lot of physical deception that plays in with tactical. So tactical is something that can be done on a faster basis than strategic, because you don't need as long to try to convey this, you know, all the way up the channels of the military command.
The tactical includes some pretty intriguing things, these deceptive things. I remember reading a little book, and this might be the first book I ever read about World War II. I think it was called The Man Who Was Never There or something like that, and it came out probably 50-something years ago, and one of their early successes where they took a body, and I think you actually covered it in here. They took a body, and they pretended that it was a British flyer, that he apparently had gotten shot down over the channel, his body washed up, and it's got secret documents and so forth, and it diverts the Germans to think that the Normandy landings were not going to be in Normandy, that they were going to be in a different place, or maybe not take place on the
Sicily.
I remember reading it as a kid and thinking, wow, this is really amazing that people would go to this much trouble. I had no idea until I read your book just how many of these types of things that they did, and this was not the one thing they did. This was just part of what they did to nudge the Germans into thinking, aha, they relied heavily on double agents and on false information that was leaked to people that they knew were going to get it back to the Germans, right?
They did. And yes, you're referring to Operation Mincemeat, and that book was written by Ewan Montague, sorry, who was part of that. And that one, yes, that was in preparation for Operation Husky, or the invasion of Sicily, because it was so obvious. So the man who ended up becoming Major Martin of the Marines was, you know, carrying these documents. That one was actually put together by the London Controlling Section in London.
Okay.
But A-Force and Dudley Clark participated in helping to draft really the most crucial document, which was a letter that was found in all of the information in the briefcase that the Germans were able to see. So what's interesting about that and all of the things you mentioned with the double agents and all of those other things is that deception could never be passed through just one bit of information or proof. There had to be all of these different elements, and Clark talks about it like they're pieces of a puzzle. You have to have all of these different pieces. They all have to support the deception. And importantly, the enemy has to put the puzzle together himself, because if you hand it to him on a silver platter, he's going to know he's being deceived.
Right. This same kind of tactic worked in Turkey, because apparently they were that was a hotbed of spies, just like Spain was, right? As a neutral nation, Spain was teeming with spies from every angle. There, it was just an open market for people working for one government or another. Did they have a register of these guys, or they just kind of knew which ones they could count on to pass the word along to the right people that would pass it and eventually would get back to the big planners or to Hitler himself?
It seemed to be both. They seemed to know that certain people would be very reliable to pass on information to the enemy, and other times they just knew that loose talk was going to make its way into the right channel. So there would be, you know, moments where they would pass something and they would say, you know, that they expected the Turks would sell that to the Germans or relay it to the Germans. So that expectation was there, but there were individuals who they knew would certainly pass the information along.
When you're talking about vendetta and turpitude, the plans that were to assist Operation Overlord, Plan Zeppelin, Vendetta, Turpitude, all of these had this brilliant idea of saying, okay, setting up the idea there's going to be an invasion somewhere else, and then always putting it off. You know, they'd leak the word, oh, it's going to happen on this day. And as it got closer to it, oh, well, it looks like we can't get this or that, so we're going to bump it another week. And by doing so, they kept kind of fishing the Germans along and convinced them more than ever that it was actually going to take place in, say, southern France or Turkey or whatever.
Yeah, the notional postponement was really a brilliant tool. On one hand, what it sometimes did was help the deceptionists, help A-Force kind of bridge a gap between deception plans, specifically strategic deception plans, where they weren't quite ready, but they had to keep that story alive and keep the machine running. And so they could go ahead and have the threat present, and then they would be able to postpone it as the deception itself kind of matured, and they could further that along. But it also had the benefit of being able to tie the Germans down in places that were not France and then keep them there. But they had to do that pretty early in the game. So, you know, for example, when you're looking at 43 after North Africa and then after Sicily, it was really important that the Germans didn't decide, okay, well, we're going to shift all of these forces over to France now. So these deceptions would go ahead and play up a threat, say, to the Balkans, to make sure that the Germans reinforced the Balkans. And just the distance and terrain, all of that meant that it was a lengthy process and they could not easily get those divisions to France. And then with the notional postponements, they keep the threat alive, they keep playing it out, and keep the Germans there.
I remember being very impressed by the numbers of companies that were kept waiting for an invasion that was never going to happen. They really did a magnificent job in diverting hundreds of thousands of Wehrmacht soldiers from sitting and waiting for an invasion that never happened.
They absolutely did. And the Balkans is the biggest example of that, where there were 25 German divisions in the Balkans, anticipating an invasion of the Balkans that the deceptionists said had to come before the invasion of France. So 25 German divisions were there, and the Allies had no intention of invading the Balkans. Then you had 10 German divisions in southern France. That did later become a genuine threat, but only after D-Day. So 10 German divisions in southern France, and then an additional 25 German divisions were in Italy, where there was a genuine campaign, but the deceptionists and A-Force did a really good job of increasing the threat level to the Germans to make sure that they reinforced to meet diversionary threats along with the genuine campaign. So all told, 60 German divisions were spread from southern France to the Balkans on June 6, 1944, when D-Day commenced.
Wow. And one of the reasons, part of what's going on at that same point is the day before the Normandy invasions is the day that Rome falls, because there's a real threat in Italy, like you said, that enables it to make it seem like there's an even bigger threat. And so the Germans have many more people than they would need, since at that point they were making a strategic withdrawal back further and further north.
Yes. And General Alexander in Italy planned his spring offensive of 1944 specifically to pin down the Germans in those months leading up to D-Day. And as you mentioned, June 4th, 1944, the Allies took Rome. Just 2 days to spare.
It's a fascinating story and really interesting. And I think that people like me who love reading about World War II will find this an indispensable book for understanding what was really going on behind the scenes and the in-depth and importance of it and the brilliance and the creativity of all these people working for a common goal. Whitney, is there anything else that you wanted to say or anything else you were hoping I would ask that I didn't? Because we can certainly do that right now.
I don't know. I didn't know what you were going to ask. But no, I mean, I just think it's important because so many people who do focus on World War II and have this interest in deception have always been aware of Plan Fortitude, which played up the threat to Pas-de-Calais instead of Normandy. And there's been a lot of emphasis there. But it's actually Plan Zeppelin carried out by A-Force in the Mediterranean, and you mentioned Vendetta and Turpitude as subsidiary plans of that. It was that campaign, that component of Operation Bodyguard, the overarching deception plan, that was the largest, the most involved, and the one responsible for pinning down so many German divisions and keeping them away from France. And all of Dudley Clark's contemporaries, military leaders of the day, recognized that if Zeppelin had failed, D-Day probably would have been unsuccessful.
Wow. It is certainly a wonderful story. I want to thank you so much for writing the book to make so many more of us aware of the brilliant organizational skills and creative genius of Dudley Clark, but also of all the people that worked with A-Force to divert and deceive the Germans in order that more lives could be saved rather than needlessly slaughtered like it happened in World War One. So thank you for that. Do you have a website people can go to learn more about your book or about your other work?
You know, I really don't have a website. I am on Facebook, so I can be found that way.
Okay.
I'm not a huge social media person, so I get asked that sometimes, and maybe I should do that.
Well, that's okay. Well, listen, I have a Facebook page that's on the bookshelf with Doc. If you want to look into it, that's where you'll find. I'll send you a copy of the review, but that's where it'll be posted as well as running on the radio. So,
okay, wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. It's been very interesting talking to you, and again, enjoyed your book very much. And
thank you so much.
When I saw it in the mail, I said, "Oh, this is the book I need to talk about for the June 6th show. This is just absolutely perfect." Mm-hmm. Thank you again for being with us today on the Bookshelf.
All right. Well, thank you so much,
Dr. Whitney Bindick. Her new book, Diversion and Deception: Dudley Clark's A-Force and Allied Operations in World War II, from the University of Oklahoma Press. She is professor and director of undergraduate studies in the International Affairs Program at Florida State University. Her previous book was A-Force, The Origins of British Deception During the Second World War. So this book builds on the research she did for her first book. And once again, you can check out the University of Oklahoma Press's website, which is oupress.com. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and on your favorite podcast. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless. In closing today, from the CD D-Day 50th Anniversary from 1993, the BBC Concert Orchestra, the Central Band of the Royal Air Force, the BBC Singers, conducted by Kenneth Alwyn, featuring speeches by General Dwight D. Eisenhower and President Franklin D. Roosevelt, this is D-Day The Landing.
Dawn, the English Channel, June 6th, 1944.
Well, this is it, boys. Tomorrow's the big show. D-Day is tomorrow. And H-Hour, when the American and our own forces go into the continent, is sometime early tomorrow morning.
Soldiers, sailors and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you.
Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed, but we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day without rest until the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. Thank you.